Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. He makes himself available every Thursday for us at a 12 o'clock hour, and we certainly appreciate the time spent because we get to talk about a lot of really interesting topics. So, Rafi, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be back, Newell. Sometimes, Rafi, they are interesting, but they may be a little depressing to hear some of them.
Oh, that is true.
Yeah.
Talking about depressing, have you had a chance to read this article in NOLA.com yet on why murder cases in New Orleans take so long?
Yeah, I did read it this morning.
Yeah. A lot of that in there is what you and I have been talking about for years. I thought it was well done. I thought it got the victim perspective, the victim's family's perspective, and just how tragic, the slowness of these cases moving through the system. But it is emblematic of really the breakdowns that you and I have talked about for a long time. Your thoughts?
Well, right. So, earlier this year, the Crime Commission released a report reporting on the size of the dockets, the pending cases in criminal district court. We also issue weekly updates on the pretrial inmates that are held in detention. So that article in today's newspaper talked about the homicide cases and how long it takes homicide cases to move through the system. That is just a subset. So at any given time, we released a report every Monday on the inmate population. As of Monday, there are 1,470 inmates in pretrial custody. 219 of them are in there for homicide. So that article today went into great depth about the homicides. But those are 219 out of 1,470. And one of the things that we've done is that we've documented not just the numbers of inmates, not just the homicide inmates, but every category of crime that inmates remain in pretrial custody. So with respect to homicide suspects, these are just the ones that remain in custody. Some of them have made bail, and they're out waiting for their due process and day in court. But the 219 inmates that are in pretrial custody, that represents 15% of the 1,470 inmates that are in jail. Their average amount of time that those 219 inmates have been in pretrial custody is 655 days. Collectively, those inmates have been in pretrial custody for 143,339 days at a cost of $124 a day to house someone pretrial. The cost just of the pretrial murder inmates is over $17 million to taxpayers.
A year.
So...
No, it's over the time that they've been in there. Since they've been in custody, sorry, yeah.
So if you just take a look at the 1,470 pretrial inmates, that costs taxpayers about $180,000 a day to house 1,470 inmates. So there is not just the delays to justice and due process and closure for victims and the cost to the criminal justice system, but just a lot of those costs are impossible to quantify. But, these are hard numbers that you can just begin to put a dollar cost on some of the inefficiencies and delays that exist. And with respect to pretrial inmates, we know that it costs $124 a day to hold an adult offender in pretrial custody and over $400 a day to hold a juvenile in pretrial custody. So There is a real cost, and you can quantify, you know, the cost of these inefficiencies. So, you know, what this article talks about in great detail is just the homicide cases and how long it takes the homicide cases to move through the system. So there are 803 violent felony offenders in pretrial custody, 219 homicide offenders, 68 being held on attempted murder charges, another 64 on rape and sex crime charges, 131 on robbery charges, 116 on domestic violence, aggravated battery and aggravated assault, 133 inmates, and home invasions and kidnappings, another 72 inmates. So that is a substantial portion of the inmate population. Another 156 inmates are in there for in the jail for weapons felonies, and the other one-third of the inmate population in there for property or drug felonies. Those offenders remain in custody because of their criminal histories, not because of the offense that they were charged with. So you're looking at, you know, the reason people want to know why crime is down in this city, it's because the police department and the Louisiana State Police have done an extraordinary job in identifying the violent and repeat offenders. And when they identify them, they arrest them. And as the inmate population has gone up, particularly when you look at the concentration of the inmate population being in pretrial custody for felony crimes of violence and felony weapons offenses, and then the fact that the property and the drug offenders remain in custody because of prior convictions, not just arrests, but convictions, then you start to realize that as these offenders are being arrested and held accountable for those charges, not only are they being brought to justice for the crime that they committed, but while they're in pretrial custody, they are not free to go out and commit additional crimes. And, you know, there is an old RAND study from the 1970s that document that about 6% of the crimes are in any community. I'm sorry, only 6% of the offenders in any community are responsible for in excess of 70% of the crimes perpetrated. So what we're seeing is the dramatic decreases in crime that have been achieved in this city are in large part because of the success of the New Orleans Police Department and the Louisiana State Police in identifying and arresting and holding accountable the violent and repeat offenders that drive up the crime rate in this town. So that article in today's newspaper is talking about just one component. Every category of crime is backed up. And that has tremendous costs, not just with pretrial inmates, but to every component of the criminal justice system. With the types of backlogs that we're seeing in criminal district court, that means that victims and witnesses and police officers come to court multiple times. The city pays out overtime to officers if they're off the clock to go to the courthouse, only to see their case continued because other cases on the docket. And when you're trying to figure out why does it take so long for homicides to be adjudicated, well, as I said, you know, there are 219 homicide inmates in the jail, and 82 of those 219 have been in pretrial custody for less than a year, and 137 of those 219 have been in custody for more than a year. In fact, 41 of those pretrial homicide inmates have been in jail for 3 or more years. So you've got 8 inmates that have been in pretrial custody waiting to be tried that have been in custody for over 5 years. So You know, this is a system problem, and the costs go beyond just how much do we have to spend housing the inmates. It literally impacts both financially, emotionally, and from an effectiveness and an efficiency standpoint, every component of the criminal justice system.
One has to ask, what are you waiting for in 5 years in jail, right? I mean, you know, my thought process always was, after 6 months of having someone in jail, your case is not getting any stronger. It's actually getting weaker. Witnesses disappear. Witnesses die. You know, evidence. You know, you have your chain of custody issues. You know, you just open yourself up to human error. It's not going to get any better. If you're not prepared to go to trial, I mean.
So this backlog started during COVID. So the system was closed down during COVID, and no criminal justice system was closed down for a longer period of time than Orleans Parish. So it wasn't until last quarter of 2022 that the system started to reopen. So we had not only COVID hit, we had a newly elected DA that had never been a prosecutor before, and a lot of the experienced personnel that were there were either asked to leave or chose to leave. So you had, juries couldn't be assembled in Orleans Parish, which meant that as individuals were being arrested, the cases would sit. And then experienced prosecutors, the criminal defense bar, particularly the public defender's office, they were equally impacted. They lost a lot of their personnel. They couldn't represent their clients. So the roots of this backlog can document back to COVID. But that doesn't excuse the extent of what's happening, because you have, you know, every component of the system, whether it be prosecutors, criminal defense bar, judges, the sheriff in some respects, everybody is responsible, has an important role to fulfill in the administration of justice. And when one component breaks down or isn't operating effectively, it impacts every other. When multiple components of the criminal justice system make mistakes, are broken down, are inefficient, ineffective, it has a multiplier effect on the backlog. And that's what we're seeing and we're trying to work through in Orleans Parish. You literally have every component of the criminal justice system that shares some responsibility, some degree of responsibility with the extent of this backlog of cases.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see. I mean, I suggested in my monologue that this requires all of the players to get together in one room, probably weekly, and, you know, get after this, listen to one another, understand what each other's challenges are, try to accommodate one another. Sometimes it's just communication breakdown. But the only way that you can ever click on all cylinders is there has to be more openness between the players. And, you know, and I think the judges need to be more proactive with pretrial planning on these cases. They need to start holding everybody's feet to the fire. There will be no continuances unless something, you know, extraordinary happens outside the control of either party. But, you know, you got to move these things along, because without throughput, you never achieve success, in my view. So we'll see exactly what happens. Let's get to a break. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafael, a real interesting case out of Jefferson Parish, and it's a racketeering case. Talk to us about that.
Well, this really got my attention, and I thought it would be appropriate to talk about with your audience in this. You know, you normally don't see these types of cases presented in state court. This indictment issued by the Jefferson Parish District Attorney's Office a week ago today is the culmination of, I think, some really impressive investigative work being conducted by law enforcement in Jefferson in coordination with, you know, New Orleans. But, you know, this is a 20-page sweeping indictment that talks about racketeering, conspiracy, and manslaughter in connection with the Super Bowl week death of the Kansas City reporter that was covering the Super Bowl, Adam Manzano. So people will remember that during Super Bowl week, New Orleans and the nation were stunned to learn that a reporter covering the Super Bowl was found dead in his hotel room in Kenner. That immediately launched an investigation by the Kenner PD, the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office, the NOPD, and other agencies as well. And their investigation was made public, or the outcome of their investigation, a week ago. And I'm going to talk about what the investigation uncovered. But there were three people indicted. Danette Colbert, who was the woman that allegedly induced the murder victim, Adam Manzano, into having some drinks with her at a bar in the French Quarter and then took him back to his hotel room and apparently drugged him. And he subsequently died of an overdose of the drugs that he took. But what the investigation uncovered, you know, with respect to this group, it initially focused on one individual, and they found out that she had two accomplices in all of this. And the investigation documented a 10-year scheme of these three individuals in targeting primarily out-of-town visitors in the French Quarter, getting them to get friendly and cozy with Colbert. She would drug them and then access their credit cards and cell phones, and some of the schemes and money that they took from their victims is astounding. So one of the cases involving Colbert was from a 2021 case in New Orleans where she encountered a guy by the name of David Butler. They had some drinks together, and when he began to feel woozy, he left with Colbert, and he later woke up and found out that his phone and wallet had been stolen, and that his phone had been used to access some of his bank accounts, and they removed over $130,000 from his retirement account and made numerous credit card charges. So it shows how this group was focused on this. But this event would not have occurred, and this is really a failure of the Orleans criminal justice system. I did a dive on Danette Colbert's criminal history. It goes back to 2012. And in 2012 in Orleans Parish, she was arrested on armed robbery charges, was allowed to plead to a misdemeanor in 2013, got 2 years suspended sentence. Was arrested again in New Orleans in 2014 on second-degree battery, intimidating witnesses, bank fraud between in excess of $500 and between $5,000, simple burglary. And she ended up pleading guilty to that, got a 5-year suspended sentence. Then in 2017, got arrested in Jefferson Parish, pled guilty, and got 3 years in the Department of Corrections. And she got out, and in 2018, she got arrested again and got a five-year suspended sentence. But in 2021, she was tried on the charge that I told you occurred in 2024, she was tried on the charge that occurred in 2021, where she stole over $130,000 from her victim. So that case went to trial. And after a lengthy trial, the jury returned a unanimous verdict of guilty. And she was, with that conviction, that was her fourth felony conviction. Under Louisiana law, you cannot receive a suspended sentence. But the judge sentenced her to, gave her a 10-year suspended sentence. So the state of Louisiana, the district attorney's office.
And that was Judge Nandy Campbell, right?
That's correct. That's right.
Yeah. This is not the first instance of this happening.
The DA's office didn't object, allowed that to happen, and not only was she not entitled to a suspended sentence, but the district attorney's office could have sought an enhancement based on her three prior felony convictions. The DA's office didn't do that either. So if the DA's office and or Judge Campbell had not allowed this defendant that wasn't entitled to receive a probated sentence, to have received that probated sentence, Adam Maizano may still be alive right now. So that's a failure of the system to hold accountable, you know, a documented offender with histories going back over a dozen years. And that mistake that was made by the judge, that omission, or whether it was intentional or whatever. If the judge had done her job and the district attorney's office had done their job, she would not have been on the streets to have victimized the reporter, Adam Maizano, during the Super Bowl of this year. So that's a failure of the system, and that failure resulted in somebody losing their life. But that investigation, you know, that was conducted in Jefferson Parish by law enforcement, a large part of that investigation was by the Jefferson Parish Crime Lab opening up the cell phones of the individuals and meticulously documenting text messages back and forth between the co-conspirators and what was happening. So the indictment lists a number of the text messages that occurred between the co-conspirators. And here's one text message, some excerpts from one text message chain in September of 2023 between Colbert and her co-defendant, White. This is Colbert. They have a guy that's been drugged and is unconscious. She's got him in the hotel room and is conversing with her co-conspirator, saying he didn't use a pen, he got an American Express, he's staying here with plenty of money and an iPhone. And she sent an emoji, you know, smiling to her accomplice, Mr. White. Colbert says he's drunk. He's almost asleep. White saying, I'm cool, buy your car. In other words, he's waiting outside when she finishes up and gets everything she can from him. He's out there with the car to drive her away. They exchange text messages about getting money from an ATM and buying gift cards. and then the credit cards start to get declined. So Colbert says that I'm on the phone with the bank now. So she has her victim's phone, and the bank is calling to verify the charges that are going through, and she is responding. So this is a sophisticated scheme that's more than just taking somebody's wallet. They're using, you know, his cell phone to access things like Social Security numbers, PIN numbers, and to verify with the bank that the illegal charges and withdrawals that they're making are in fact authorized by their victims, when in reality they're not, because their victims are drugged and unconscious while these people are siphoning as much money as they can from these individuals. So in the indictment, they list at least 10 instances of theft and fraud by this trio between September of 23 and February of 25. The investigation documents that they've been doing this for over 10 years, primarily in the French Quarter. So why did it take 10 years to catch them? Well, many of their victims are out-of-towners that are embarrassed by what happened, and they may not want to report it and cooperate. The one that did, that Mr. Butler, when he was victimized in 2021, he didn't back down. The case was well worked up by the police department and successfully prosecuted by the DA's office. So up until then, everything went well. But after the conviction, the district attorney's office failed and the judge failed by putting a repeat offender that the judge had just heard and the prosecution had just presented proof beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that this person was involved in activity in which she was drugging her victims, and the potential of an overdose was there by the grace of God. Nothing happened to the victim in that case, other than his money was siphoned from him. But we weren't so lucky in 2025 when she overdosed her most recent victim, her last victim. And thank goodness for the good work that was done by the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office, the Kenner Police Department, the NOPD, and cooperating with them. And additional evidence was also documenting Colbert's connection with Mazzano from the Project NOLA crime cameras in the French Quarter. So this is, you know, an example of the good work that's done by law enforcement and the cooperation between all the various agencies, a very meticulous and professional job done by the Jefferson Parish District Attorney's Office in documenting a sweeping conspiracy and racketeering charges that culminated with the death of that reporter that was in town for the Super Bowl. But it also shows the consequences of the failure of the district attorney's office and the judge to properly sentence the individual, that had they done that, there's a good chance that this reporter would still be alive and we wouldn't be dealing with this case now.
Yeah, tragic. Tragic for sure. Did that sentence, that illegal sentence that was issued by Judge Nandy Campbell, did that ultimately get resolved and corrected?
Yeah, right. So under the law, after you're not entitled to a fourth suspended sentence or a probated sentence without the concurrence of the DA. The DA didn't concur, but the Attorney General's office stepped in after this, Liz Merle's office, and she attempted to say that that was an illegal sentence, which I agree with her, it was an illegal sentence. But apparently the judge said that the district attorney's office, by not objecting, tacitly agreed to the suspended sentence. So Liz Merle said, well, I have the authority to seek enhancement under the habitual offender statute. And she filed a multiple bill against that offender, and the person that received a 10-year suspended sentence is now serving 20 years in the Department of Corrections for that crime while she's waiting to be tried on the Jefferson Parish charges. So a 20-year sentence in 2024 is something that the district attorney's office could have and should have achieved. Judge Campbell should not have granted probation to this four-time offender. And because they didn't do their job, someone lost their life. And now, you know, the Jefferson Parish criminal justice system is going to have to hold this group accountable for the crimes that they perpetrated during the period of time that was documented in the indictment.
I'm glad that that got corrected and that that individual's waiting in jail for the next sentencing that will be coming her way, certainly. We'll be right back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President of Metropolitan Crime Commission. When we come back, we'll talk about Sheriff Susan Hudson being found in contempt of court. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President of Metropolitan Crime Commission. Last week, Rafi, the Orleans Criminal District Court issued an en banc order holding Orleans Parish Sheriff Susan Hudson in contempt of court. Tell us what happened here.
Okay, so, you know, it's not every day that the sheriff gets held in contempt of court, and I'm not an apologist for her. I mean, Lord knows that she has her flaws and problems, but as I looked into this, I agree with the position of the sheriff on this particular case. So what the court concluded is that the sheriff was in contempt of court because the court ordered her to bring over inmates for magistrate court proceedings on weekends and holidays. So we started talking about some of the delays in the system. And when the system was shut down, as it was beginning to reopen, inmates couldn't be brought from the jail to the court, so they used Zoom hearings. The inmates, for first appearance purposes, would be brought to a special video room, and they wouldn't have to be transported to court. So in addition to housing the inmates, the sheriff is responsible for transporting inmates to and from court proceedings and also for providing security for the jail. So as the system reopened, the sheriff's office began bringing inmates for magistrate court Monday through Friday, but on weekends and holidays, she would only make them available via Zoom, and that was working perfectly well. So in lieu of the offender being brought to court, the offender would step into the Zoom courtroom that's in the jail. And the defense counsel would have the ability to either meet in person with their clients, or they could have confidential Zoom conferences with their clients before the actual hearing. And then the offenders the judge from the courtroom or the magistrate commissioner from the courtroom would have access to the offender, and the offender would have access to what was transpiring in the court. Prosecutors were attending via Zoom, defense counsel via Zoom, or in person over in the courtroom, and it was working perfectly well. But at some point in time, the judges said, well, if you're doing it during the week, we want you to bring them over on the weekends. Under Louisiana law, an offender is entitled to a bail hearing within 72 hours of arrest, excluding weekends and holidays. The sheriff's office was still complying with the 24-hour Orleans Parish policy, by allowing the inmates to have their bail set from the jail rather than bring them over to court. The sheriff claims that it cost about 12 deputies, because not only does she need to bring the inmates over from the jail, she needs to have security in the courtroom, and those hearings are public. The public can attend a Zoom hearing via Zoom, but if it's in the courtroom and there is no Zoom, it means that the court has to be open at on holidays and weekends, which means there has to be security at the front door of the jail as well, of the court as well. So I think the sheriff was correct with this policy that she put in place, saying this is unnecessary. It's working perfectly fine the way it's been working since COVID. Because of the personnel shortages that I have and the other security concerns that our priorities in the jail, will make the inmates available, and it was working perfectly fine. But I think the mistake that was made was the sheriff ignored the orders and just disregarded the orders. And at the 11th hour, she sent her attorney in and didn't appear before the judges. And I think that that was the reason for the contempt order being issued. I suspect that nothing's going to be done to the sheriff. And all this, in fact, I can't figure out why, but last weekend the sheriff, you know, maybe, you know, made her deputies bring the inmates to court. So she has backed down from her position, but I think that her position and reasoning was appropriate and correct. It didn't adversely impact the system. And, you know, I think that what happened in this particular case was unnecessary and put the criminal justice system in a bad light with the public. But, you know, here's another example of the system, you know, inability to resolve some differences between the judiciary and the sheriff's office.
Kind of highlights what I said before. Right. I mean, Getting in the same room, understanding each other's challenges that they have, trying to work out a solution. You know, not everybody's going to be in the comfort of what they are accustomed to if you really want to work it out. It's the interest of the public that really matters, not the interest of these individuals. And unfortunately, you elect people and they forget where they came from. I don't know how else to say it. You know, it's like everybody's taxed to the max, so why not figure out a way? I mean, because this goes to throughput as well, right? I mean, it very much influences throughput. It's nice to have a magistrate court that runs 7 days a week. I actually worked in that court for overtime on Saturdays and Sundays, so I know all the way back to the 70s. You know, and Those folks that deserved bail and could get out of jail, you want to get them out because, you know, you want to be able to put other people in that are much more serious offenders. But, you know.
You're right. The sheriff has an interest in low-level offenders having their bail set and released from custody to make room for the more serious offenders that are coming in on a daily basis. And she was accomplishing that via the Zoom conferences that were being done. You know, like you, I worked in the district attorney's office, and in the 1980s, I remember going over to the jail for those hearings, and the magistrate commissioner, the public defender, the prosecutor, myself, would all be there, and we would do that in some evenings, on weekends, and holidays. And it worked perfectly fine. And it was working perfectly fine for all of the years since COVID, but it became an issue that, you know, resulted in the unfortunate dispute between the sheriff's office and the judges that now may be resolved. But again, it is, I think, a black eye for the criminal justice system, an example of, you know, the point that you're making and we've been talking about for a couple of years is the inability of the system to work together effectively to provide for the safety of the public and the performance of their elective duties.
We need some adults in the room, for sure. As always, Rafi Goyeneche, we truly appreciate your time, your insight. President, Metropolitan Crime Commission, have a great weekend.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, we have some politics to talk about. Also, the passing of Hulk Hogan. You know, people say that celebrities die in threes. Well, now we've got four that have happened kind of recently. So we'll touch on that a little bit. But we'll try to have fun this afternoon.
All righty, Scoot's headed your way. Have a great Thursday evening. We'll see you again in the morning.